Today's episode of Tech Talks on the Unsettled Media Podcast Network is brought to you by Tech Impact, focused on unlocking prosperity by embracing technology. For more, head to techimpact.it.
Welcome back to Tech Talks, or if you're new to the show, welcome to Tech Talks. I'm your host, Kathy Simpson. Here at Tech Impact, we love telling the stories of the people and the companies that are doing remarkable things here in Atlantic Canada. And this podcast is one of the channels to do exactly that. I love every episode that we've done, and today is number 27, and our third episode in our diversity and inclusion series. This week's conversation is with Mike Wright and Dr. Lino Caramancheri, co-founders of Mesh Diversity. Mike hails from Woodstock, New Brunswick. We're on quite a roll with our last two guests, and now Mike, being from that part of New Brunswick, otherwise known as Carleton County. Amazing, really, and I love to see all of that thought leadership coming from rural New Brunswick. And Lino is from Toronto, with ties to Newfoundland, and that was where he was today for our episode in St. John's. Mike graduated from UMB with both a business and computer science degree, and immediately fell in love with the intersectionality of the two fields. His career has been with IT and engineering firms in New Brunswick, while he's been that person, that leader living outside of the province for the companies. He is one of the co-founders of Mesh Diversity, and you're going to learn all about that organization today. We talk about the name. You don't want to miss that part of the conversation. And Lino, as one of the other founders of Mesh, comes from a completely different background. While attending York University in his third year, he took a race and racism course, and that paved the way to the rest of his university education and career. He went on to get his PhD in sociology and equity studies at the University of Toronto. And for all of you, it will become clear during our episode that diversity and inclusion is clearly Lino's lifelong work. Let's dive in with these two leaders from Mesh to learn more about them, how they started the company, and what they're hopeful about as we look ahead in creating safe, diverse, and inclusive cultures and companies. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talks. I'm excited because I have two guests today that are doing some amazing work in the diversity and inclusion space. I'm going to start out with introducing you to Mike Wright. Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and give us a real proper introduction?
Perfect. Thanks, Kathy. It's amazing for you to have us. Thank you. My name's Mike Wright. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Mesh Diversity. I'm originally from New Brunswick. I grew up in a small town in New Brunswick called Woodstock, and went to UMB. Did both a computer science degree and a business degree. And that's, I think, when my career took what I consider a bit of an interesting journey. I ended up working for New Brunswick-based firms, but living outside of the province in both Montreal and Toronto. And when it came time to start Mesh Diversity, that was a model that we had found worked. And that's when myself and Lino and our co-founders got together. We founded Mesh and wanted the organization based in New Brunswick.
Tell me, what got you into CS and business? How did you pull that off?
You know, it's an interesting story. So when I graduated from high school, I went into science, and I very quickly found that I wasn't mature enough to handle the workload for science right out of the gate. And that's not to say that business wasn't a heavy workload at all. But it just spoke more to me. So I made the switch halfway through my first term into business and just found that I really, really enjoyed it. But at the time, back in the early 90s, it felt like your choices were finance, marketing, or accounting from a business perspective, because it was pre-dot-com, the first boom. And none of those really appealed to me. And I remember one of my friends coming back. They were a couple years older than me, and they came back from an information session with Anderson Consulting. And we're talking about this ability to be a, a technical consultant and travel all over the world and 4 weeks away and 1 week at home. And I was like, that's what I want to do. How do I do that? Oh, CS? Okay. I'm going to enroll in computer science. So that's how I wound up taking CS as well. I made the decision in my third year of university.
Did it take you very long to realize once you got working that you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Because you worked for Bravada, so small startup company, and you were there a long time.
Yep. It did. I think that was probably, it was my time at Bravada that really kind of sparked that interest, because I saw what we were doing as an organization, and it was quite exhilarating to, I joined as employee number 15. Mm-hmm. And by the time I had left, we were up around 50. So it was an exhilarating ride. And I felt that was something that I didn't want to miss out on.
So how did it end up that you moved away from the region, but for the past 15 years, at least, all your connectivity has been to organizations in the region? Starting Mesh, even though you're outside the region, you've got strong roots here. So that's an interesting story I'd love to hear.
Yeah, for sure. And it's one of those things that the first firm I worked with was an engineering firm, and we were based in Fredericton, but had an office in New Jersey and an office in Montreal. And so that concept of, staying close to home, having access to home, but at the same time being out experiencing the world, because that's really why I got into it. I wanted to travel. I wanted to see things, which was really appealing. And I went from there to an organization called the Anywhere Group, which was St. John based. And that gave me the opportunity to really, the team that I was with there, we were traveling all over the world, helping telephone companies around the world. And that was just something that I loved. And I fell into this this lifestyle of being out and experiencing things, but always having that opportunity to get back home. And so I did that through Bravada as well here in Toronto.
Sure.
But spent time back with the team in both of our offices in Moncton and St. John. And so when it came time to start Mesh, my co-founders, one of them being from Moncton, our CTO Jason Obey, we said, look, this model works. There's an opportunity. I'm happy to stay here, not forever. My wife and I are we're planning our return. But our kids are at that age where they need to stay where they're at. But being able to build a business where you're a little bit closer to a larger center, but really drive growth in the employee base back into the province of New Brunswick is a model that I've done as an employee, and it's one as a founder that I find works really, really well, and I see it as a real plus for the province and a plus for us as a business.
And then you meet characters like Lino, who are joining us here today. He's actually in St. John's, Newfoundland, which is near and dear to my heart and many of us here in Atlantic Canada. Great to have you as well, Lino.
Thanks so much, Kathy. It's lovely to be here.
So your background's definitely different from Mike's. Tell us where you grew up and what was life like for you? Where did you go off to school and learn a thing or two?
Well, I grew up in Toronto.
And we won't hold that against you, Lino.
Yes. No, please don't. I grew up in Toronto in Scarborough and went to university, York University. And, as many people when they're 18 or 19 years old had no clue what I wanted to do. So I think my first year I was a humanities major. And then I think my second year I was a poli-sci major and was getting solid C's and D's because I hated every minute of both of those, both of those lines. And then in my third year, I took a race and racism course with a professor named Himani Banerjee, who I think changed the world for me. It was not so much of a, so I can't frame it as big as it was, as the closest I could get is changed the world for me. I started to see, why my experience was what it was as a fine cocoa brown young boy growing up in Toronto, how racism had impacted me, why I felt the things that I did. It was just, it was mind altering, and it set me on the path that I'm on today.
It's crazy how one person can have that kind of an impact on you. And did you know right away that there was something here that sparked some magic inside you?
No, not at all. I mean, I grew up in Scarborough, but by the time I was in grade eight, we moved to Markham, and the local high school was only being built. So we got bused into Richmond Hill High School, which was an exceedingly white, exceedingly wealthy area. And so, you know, my experiences of racism just got even larger there. So I did what a good chunk of, you know, young kids of color do. They, you know, you try to assimilate as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So I think by the time I had gotten into Himani Banerjee's class, I outside of all the visible evidence to the contrary, I think I felt as white as I could possibly be. And so in her class, she was really pissing off the white kids. Like, I think after every single class, somebody would go to the dean and complain about her. And after three or four classes, I decided it was upon me to go tell her that she was racist towards white people. So I very strategically waited until the end of one of her lectures and everybody had carted out, and I walked up to her. And now this is an exceedingly renowned and politicized professor that she could have ripped shreds off of me. But I walked up to her and I said, you know, Professor Banerjee, I think you're racist towards white people. And she looked at me with such kindness in her eyes. And she said, you know, Lino, you're either going to go through life with blinders on, or you're going to see the world for what it is. And when she said it, it was very, very much like a sheet got pulled off of my face. I started getting flashbacks. I started remembering all sorts of things that I had blocked out of memory. I remembered this older kid, Cameron, riding his bike. Like, I was coming home from school. I could see my mom coming home with two bags of groceries each hand. And this older kid, Cameron, on a bike threw the back end of a carrot about, you know, 2 inches into her spine, screaming, Packy, go home. I completely blocked that out of memory until that moment. So it was that it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And so what do? You know, when you're 20 years old and you're faced with the reality of racism for the first time.
Sure.
I wandered around for about, it would have been 3 days or so, in a complete and utter daze. And by the end of that, I'd figure, you know, screw this. I'm just going to become a doctor or a lawyer or something that my parents want me to be. And I walked home and I opened the door, and my dad was in the middle of watching Man of La Mancha. Have you ever seen it?
No, never seen it.
It's a musical based on the book Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes. And the story is about this man who sees the misery and cruelty in the world, and he broods and broods and broods until he loses his mind. He goes insane. He imagines that he's a knight, you know, sallying forth across the land to save damsels in distress and all of this good stuff. And the play is actually about the author Cervantes going to jail for being a heretic. And the scene I walked into was he's been put on trial by his fellow prisoners. And he's got to give his defense. And they're accusing him of being a fool, an honest man, and someone who refuses to see the world for what it is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I walked in right in time for his soliloquy. It burned into my head. He said, I have lived for over 40 years, and I have seen misery, cruelty beyond belief. I've been a soldier and a slave. I've watched my comrades fall in battle or die more slowly under the lash in Africa. I've held them at the last moments, and these were men who saw life as it is. But they died despairing. No glory, no brave last words, only their eyes questioning why. And I do not think they're asking why they were dying, but why they had ever lived. Mm-hmm. When life itself seems lunatic, who knows where madness lies? To perhaps be too practical is madness. To surrender dreams, this may be madness. To seek treasure where there is only trash, too much sanity may be madness. But maddest of all is to see life as it is and not as it should be. And in that moment, I made a decision as to what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I think that's what you do as a sociologist, right? You kind of see what it is, see where it kind of could be, and map the route in some ways.
Wow, that's a powerful story. And so you went on to become a doctor.
Yeah.
You got your doctorate. Tell us a little bit about where you did that.
Well, it was an interesting route because when I finished my undergrad at York, I wanted to learn a little bit about the quantitative aspect of sociology. So I went to University of Manitoba and studied with a wonderful professor named Leo Dreiger, and then came back to Toronto and did my doctorate at the University of Toronto at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, and focused in race and ethnic studies.
So essentially, you've worked your whole career in this space.
Mm-hmm. And but since about 20 years old. Jeez, 31 years.
You know, sometimes you get a calling. Well, I think you had your calling.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Certainly did. So how did the two of you guys connect? And how did that relationship get started?
You take that one, Mike.
Yeah, I'm going to start that. So it's one of those things that we kind of joke about, is that oftentimes all roads lead back to Woodstock. There seems to be
some
Woodstock connection. So one of my best friends, or best man at my wedding, actually, from Woodstock, left after high school, moved to Toronto, went to U of T. In my journey through my career, brought me to Toronto while I was working with that engineering firm out of Fredericton. And it was easy because he was there and I jumped right into a social setting. And that's where I met Lino. I met Lino in that social setting. And, you know, in and around that time, was when I was going through my, 2IC, second in command peer group of the Wallace McCain Institute. And, you know, Lino and I were at a social event, and I was talking about some of the things that I was doing and some of the things that I wanted to do. And, you know, this was in the early days of when he was trying to build a piece of software to do, you know, kind of what he wanted to do. And he said, well, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. And I'm like, can I be the beta tester for this? Like, I want to leverage this. And he's like, yeah, for sure. So that's really kind of what brought us together professionally. That first iteration that he was handling on his own left quite a bit to be desired.
Let's just say sociologists should not create software. I discovered that painfully at great personal cost.
I bet it was pretty.
It was very, very pretty and didn't work at all. Did they not? All emails had to have .com addresses at that time.
There was a few issues in there.
But, Lino, how did you know that Mike might be the guy to work with you?
I believe we were at a social gathering and Mike asked me, what are you doing? And my exact words were something along the lines of, I'm trying to create some software, but I can't get the damn thing to work. And then Mike looked at me with the kind of face that only an old friend can give you, that it basically saying you're an idiot without saying you're an idiot. And he said, you do know I'm in software, right? And that's where it kicked off.
So how did you know that you needed metrics around this space? You needed a platform around this space? Because you'd been working in D&I for a while by the time this happened.
Yeah, so I think it was a combination of a number of different things. I'd graduated with the doctor in 2003 and worked in an organization for a short amount of time leading their D&I initiative, and discovered that it was just not for me. You know, doing trainings on this and then having people say grossly homophobic and, you know, sexist things in training, then having to smile at them in the hallway the next day, it became a little bit untenable. So I started my own consulting practice, and after about 10 years of doing what I thought was good work, what I discovered is every time the CEO would leave or the champion would leave, or it just, you know, it just went back to scratch. And so that became, yeah, it didn't feel really great doing what you thought was good work and discovering that it just could be dismantled in a heartbeat. So that was one piece. The second piece is in and around 2008, I had done an emotional intelligence assessment. Excuse me. And realized that there was a massive dovetail between EQ and all of the sociology that I had learned all those years. And one of the real powerful things was being able to metricize it in a platform. So that's part of what I was trying to build when Mike and I got together, building a way to metricize this thing that I was framing the diversity intelligence approach. And once Mike and Obe were on board, it took on a very different life than I thought it could and had even imagined that it would be. So.
And at that time, Mike, were you looking to be a founder, to get something, to do something different? So the timing worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it was. I was at that point in my career, that I wanted to build something. I wanted to see something start from essentially nothing and grow into something. So the timing was absolutely perfect.
And how did Lino's problem of not being able to build the software, how did the problem have enough interest for you that you thought, yeah, metricizing D&I, geez, that's an interesting space. How did you get excited about that?
You know what? It's really interesting because I was actually approaching the problem from an organizational development lens. Being very transparent, the D&I side was not the true route at the time for me. But in embarking on this journey, and it's something that we say a lot, that once you see these things, you can't unsee them. And once you learn them, you can't unlearn them. So, what started for me as an organizational development thing very quickly became, oh my goodness, this is how the world looks. This is how the world works. I had no idea. I had no idea at all. So we had gotten started, but that shift happened very, very quickly, just in really getting underneath and learning.
So, Lino, what were you trying to build? I mean, now you call it a diversity intelligence platform, but back then, what were you trying to build?
Well, it was still the diversity intelligence platform at the time. It's just that it couldn't make it work, Kathy. It was very, very simplistic. Originally, and I actually, this is really interesting. Originally, the framework for pulling the data was a survey model. It was a standard Likert style, you know, 1 to 10 survey model. And as we were putting this together, Mike kept saying to me, I can't remember what the root of that. Where you had seen it, heard it, I think you'd had some counsel from somebody that those are not great internally in organizations. You have to have some kind of a model that people can't game. And you were fairly insistent upon that. And it took about 2 or 3 years to kind of wrap our heads around the model that would work. And then we had to create the model because it didn't exist. So in total, it was 6 years of research and design to create this survey design model that you couldn't really game. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if Mike's a micromanaging boss and he's my CEO and you give me a survey to how you like working with Mike, I'm going to give him a 10. It's awesome. And then you can say, well, don't worry, it's anonymous. So I'll say, absolutely, he's a 10 because I don't want to get in trouble. Well, there's that layer of fear. And then there was an internalized piece of, I'm answering stuff around D&I that's about my identity. I don't want to answer in a way that I feel is the wrong answer. I don't want to come across to anyone else, let alone myself, like I'm sexist or a homophobe or any of those things. So it's really necessary that the way in which you answer the question, that there is no easily discernible right or wrong answer. And in that way, you can get to the truth of how people genuinely feel about themselves, about the people with whom they work, about organizational culture.
So let's dive right into the platform. But first, tell us what the name Mesh Diversity, where did it come from and what does it mean for you guys?
I'll let you start the story.
We originally were, our organization was called Enkidu, which...
See, the face you just made, Kathy, that,
That tells the whole story right there.
I'm like, how do you spell that? That would be some interesting trying to get someone to find you using SEO.
Yeah.
we had someone who worked for us for a number of years who consistently pronounced it Enkidu, and she couldn't get it straight in her head.
I love it. Okay. Yeah. That's a good start. It only went up from there.
Yes. Yeah. And I'll give you the super short version. That comes from, Mesopotamian, like the oldest story ever recorded. And essentially, it's this character in Kidu. There's this mad king Gilgamesh, who is not doing right by his people. And if people cry to the gods, please send us someone to help. This wild man in Kidu comes down from the forest and, they battle and fight and they become really good friends. And in Kidu and ends up becoming a consultant or a colleague to Gilgamesh to help them. And so we thought, this is the greatest backstory. This ties into what we're doing. There's, we can help organizations when it comes to D&I. We can be there in Kidu. It's just it. And you're bang on SEO. What's in Kidu? Who, there's no tie in D&I, and no one could say it. So I'll let you pick up, why we transitioned to Mesh.
I was in a car coming back from a training in an airport, and I was on with Mike and our other founders, and we're just we're just brainstorming names. And I don't remember who came up with Mesh. I like to believe it was me. it just made sense. We help people mesh. It just made sense. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it amazing? Sometimes the simplest things make the most sense, even though you didn't understand it. So,
what you're saying, Kathy, is you like Mesh more than you like Enkidu?
Definitely. I would highly recommend. It's a much better name for the organization. So let's just get the timeline straight. When did you start working together before, you had a company? And then when did the company really come together? Help our listeners understand that.
Yeah, for sure. I think that being what I will call mature founders, gave us some advantages that we were able to take care of. Lino talks about the research that went into this. So we all were doing other things while we were kind of, getting this together. And really it was in 2017 when we really kind of came to market with our offering. And, I became employee number one. Jason Obey, one of our other co-founders, very quickly became employee number two. And we kind of brought it to market, and we had, we had a few early adopters, that really helped get us going. But it, like any startup, it was a tough road. It was a tough road at the start. I think that, you'd walk into a meeting and everyone's starting to kind of think about it, but starting to think about D&I, but not in the way that they think about it today. Because the first question was always ROI. Show me the ROI. Talk to me about how I get this ROI piece. And Lino, I'll let you pick up on that to kind of talk about how the landscape has shifted when it comes to that.
Well, I think you want to think them as like mini earthquakes. Like the Me Too movement was a very, very mini earthquake in the field. Unfortunately, there was still lots of opportunity for people to turn a blind eye if they wanted to. You could blame the dearth of female talent on a multitude of different things, right down to pipeline and all of those things. But when George Floyd was murdered, it was just an absolute earthquake, sea change. You pick the metaphor. It changed the world. Like, I don't think I'm exaggerating, Mike. Have we had one ROI question since? No. And I think, Kathy, it goes to something else. I've been saying for 20 years that a lot of my more politicized colleagues don't like that I say, but there is a reality to it that we've seen borne out since George Floyd. The only way you get systems like this, the D&I issue is not a people problem. It's a systems problem. It exists outside your organizations. It comes into your organizations. It flourishes, right? And the only way you get systems like racism and sexism and heterosexism and ableism to work is you need good, kind, ethical, moral, decent people to take part in them without recognizing that they take part in them. And, you know, back when I was in school, it was a very, very simple thing to say, if people don't want to, they're resistance because they don't want to lose their power. Mm-hmm. It's a very simplistic way to look at it. Mike and his wife, they introduced Laura and I to this great show called Ted Lasso. It's not great for diversity purposes. Everybody's white, but they popularized a Walt Whitman quote, which was really simple. Be curious, not judgmental. And I think that's something that the EQ brought to the work that we were doing as well, because it's not as simple as people just being resistant because or wanting to hold on to power. It's much more complex. And if you're part of this really large, invisible system and you take part in it every day without recognizing it, these are folks who can be absolutely well-meaning and still be asking for ROI, right? Because they don't see the need. Because they're ensconced in the system. But what George Floyd, what his murder did, is it just broke down that wall. And then what we've seen, and evidence to what we've been saying for 20 years, a whole pile of good, ethical, moral, decent people just went, oh my God, this is actually real and it's actually happening. We have to do something. This is this far, no further. I'm not continuing. So we've seen really, really earnest leadership teams, all the way from startups up to massive multinationals, saying, we're going to do this. We're going to do it real. We're not going to, you know, put the D&I portfolio in the lap of somebody who is female just because that's her credentials for leading the portfolio, or someone who's gay. That's their credentials. We've seen a lot of very, very earnest, very well-meaning leaders say, okay, we need some expertise. We need to do this right. And it's been a massive change since George Floyd.
How did all of that affect both of you and your teams when a gravely unjust, terrible set of events happened with his murder that would have made your team go, okay, we are on to helping to solve a societal issue? It had to have been very emotionally conflicting. Does that make sense?
Can I take that one, Mike?
Yeah, for sure.
it wasn't really conflicting. I can't speak for everybody else. It wasn't conflicting for me because it had been my life's work anyway. Like I'd seen it. George Floyd was only the most recent. It's not like there weren't other pieces, right? So in the same way that everything that's going on with the residential school discovery.
Absolutely.
It's not new news. We've known about these things for a while. I can't bring myself to read articles on it. It's a little too much. But as an organization, this is kind of what we were founded to do. And so while it's taking a lot of other people by surprise, not really taking us by surprise, we kind of saw the road coming. And you know, Mike will say this. We have the same conversation over and over again. I will say, you know what? The world would be in a very, very different place if George Floyd hadn't happened. And almost like to the heartbeat right after, Mike will say, if it wasn't George Floyd, it would have been someone else.
Because I believe that. Yeah. But I think you made a really good point, Lino. It's the case that the world saw.
Yep.
Versus I saw this and you saw this in different media channels, but the world saw this and the whole world woke up and said, what the hell is going on here? Like,
yeah, Yeah.
There's like something here.
It's a confluence of a lot of events, right? I think COVID had the entire world stuck at home watching TV, and all you could see was Rashard Brooks, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd. Like, it was nonstop. And we were stuck at home being forced to see it. So, you know, it was hard to close your eyes to it.
So, Mike, do you take a breath and go, team, now's our time to make this right? We have tools and mind power and thought leadership to help companies and organizations. Is that what happened for you throughout some of this?
Yes, but with a slight twist, because our approach, our messaging, it hasn't changed. Yeah. What's changed is how people hear it. So our team, anyone that's a member of our team have been living and growing just as I did in starting to work with Lino to understand this stuff. So it was less me saying, hey, you know, team. It was the team saying, we're ready. Let's go. So.
Yeah, I think that's a great sentence. Our messaging hasn't changed. It's how the world is hearing it. That's pretty powerful. So let's talk about it. Tell us about your platform. Tell us about how we can get engaged. I know it's lots of science and data science all together, but it would be wonderful for our listeners to understand what you're doing today.
Yeah. Mike, can I give a bit of a backdrop and then you can?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, if you punch in diversity and inclusion best practices into Google, you end up at what we affectionately call the echo chamber of nonsense. It's just 30 years of failed strategies that people keep regurgitating and working at. Training, we have decades of evidence that D&I training doesn't do anything. And when it does do something, oftentimes it's drive friction internally. And the good chunk of that is because of the approach. If I ask you to take medicine, it's one thing. You probably don't want to, but if I ask you to take medicine and you don't think you're sick, it's a whole other thing. And so the approach for too much D&I training has been, these are all the horrible things. This is how you're connected to it. And if you don't get it and you don't hear what I'm saying, then you're bad. And it tends to drive an awful lot of resistance just by the approach alone. Like, you can be absolutely truthful and say all the right things and echo the science. But human beings, we have some really interesting idiosyncrasies. And one of them is, if we don't like what we hear, we can easily turn it off. Yeah, absolutely. We will do a song with everything from motivated reasoning to confirmation bias to cognitive dissonance. We have a whole playbook internally that allows us to just cull the information we want to hear and use that. So training's not particularly useful if it's just done in isolation, if it's just that's your route, right? And then you have the other major approaches. You'll have, again, very earnest, very well-meaning organizations say, okay, we don't have enough women in leadership. So let's plug the holes. Let's bring some leaders in. Well, Mercer did a massive study of the financial sector. It was global. And the Canadian results were really, really interesting. It was 2017. What they found was at the professional level, women made up about 47% of professionals. And they're just strictly looking at gender. They weren't looking at intersections or race or anything else. At the professional level, it was 47%. By the time you got up to the executive suite, it was down to 15%. But the most important thing that was most telling is they were leaving at twice the rate of their male counterparts, right? So if it's as simple as plugging holes, then the people will stay when they're there and they'll be able to thrive when they're there. So the part that general DE&I approaches miss is the deep science. It's not just people keeping you down. It's whether or not people actually want to go up.
Sure.
Right? And whether they can stay. And so the best way to describe this is anytime you're thinking about taking something on, if it's whether it's I want to try a new job, go for a promotion, or pick up a guitar and learn how to play guitar,
your brain goes through a complex little set of calculations, right? There's a little algorithm. First question is, do I want to do this? You know, this is really about your interest. Is it going to be fun? You know, will I enjoy this? Will I look back in 10 years and be happy that I did it, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
If that's a check mark, then the next question is, you know, can I do it? do I have the ability to do it? You know, if I pick up a guitar and discover I have no rhythm, I'm probably going to put the guitar down pretty quickly, right? But let's say I have the skill sets to try for this job or try for this promotion. Check mark. The third one is, will I do it? Now, this is about track record. This is about how well you know yourself. Like, am I the kind of person who does 19 different things at a time, never really hone in on one, and, you know, kind of not successful? Or am I kind of the kind of person who does one thing at a time? I do it really hard and succeed, and then I move on. If that's a check mark, awesome. But the fourth piece that people don't really think about is, will this ecology support me? If I'm in this space, will people want me there? Will they help me to fail forward? Will I be able to reach my potential? If that one is an unknown, that ambiguity alone is oftentimes enough to keep people from striving. And it has everything to do with the psychology of safety. Like, Kathy, did you ever in the course of your career have a micromanaging boss?
Of course.
Okay.
Impossible not to.
Impossible not to.
And I'm sure I've been that too, you know, at times. So I can give it and I can take it too, you know. So yes, I know what a micromanaging boss looks like.
So here's the joy of micromanagement. If you've got a micromanaging boss and it's a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 job, your stress usually starts between 3 and 5 o'clock on Sundays. Because totally. Between 3 and 5 o'clock on Sundays, your amygdala, that's your early warning sign in your brain. It sends you a little message that really quickly says, okay, listen, you're going to have dinner. You're going to watch a couple TV shows, maybe read a book, and then you're going to sleep. You wake up and go back there. And it starts to put your system into an elevated baseline level of stress called hyperarousal. It's just preparing you for the next event. It can affect your sleep and cause insomnia. If you work underneath that micromanaging boss for an extended period of time, it can cause all sorts of other issues like hypertension, heart-related diseases, all sorts of stuff, right? And that's one boss in a given space for a time period you know you have to deal with them. When's the next time you're going to experience sexism? Who's it going to come from? How long will the duration of the event be? Will it be personal? Will it be professional? Will it impact your family or will it impact your career? When you don't know from whom, from where, how long, it's impossible to develop that sense of just normal safety. And that's just gender. If you're a woman of color, you get to do that calculation for two different things. And, you know, if you're a lesbian, you get three in the shebang. So the piece that misses in standard D&I, we do these really, really surface level approaches to it, such that, okay, I'll plug the hole. So we need some women. So let's get some women in this hole. Well, I've met some white women that were racist. So you can plug the hole with that woman, but she might be a racist or she might be a homophobe. So unless you're looking at the pieces that actually make a difference in terms of inclusive environments, and that has everything to do with behavior, you're going to be stuck on this treadmill doing the same old, and wondering why things don't change. And that's why we developed the diversity intelligence platform. And Mike, I'll let you explain it with greater care than I could.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. No,
for sure. And that is exactly it. It's around putting behavioral metrics on safety, belonging, and inclusion, and allowing organizations not just to have those metrics, but to have those metrics on an ongoing basis. So you constantly know where you're at, because organizations are living. They change, they morph, different things are happening. So understanding those metrics on an ongoing basis and providing actionable insight at the individual and the team level to actually be able to get out in front of what's happening and arm your people with the ability to understand and make real-time course corrections. So that's layer number one. Layer number two is, we've got an entire inclusive leadership program that for the leaders in the organization to actually be able to build that out and understand the behavior piece. And this is not about, and I think that, just to pick up on what Lena was talking about, one of the other failings of a lot of D&I work is that it's approached from, I'm going to come in and I'm going to teach you to be a D&I expert. I'm going to give you all this information about D&I, and that's the focus of the training. Well, most organizations, the majority of the people, that's not why they took the job. That's not why they're there. And this concept that I'm going to give you all this information, and then I'm going to go back and I'm going to hope that you're going to do something with it. Well, there are very few business strategies where the big pillar is hope, right?
Very few.
Yeah. Like you know, our approach and the information that we're giving is showing how this plays out in your organization. So there's very much a what's in it for me from the leadership perspective, but from, our stuff is around communication and, civility and how these various behaviors play out in your organization, and then allow you to see them through a D&I lens. And one of the other interesting pieces that is a part of all of our inclusive leadership program is, for lack of a better term, it's a choose your own adventure. And Lino, I'm going to let you pick up on the why for that and the impact and power that brings to organizations.
Yeah. When Mike was saying earlier that, the vast majority of people in any organization didn't take the job or go to school for that job or to learn D&I, there's a reality behind that. If I'm an engineer and I spent 4 years becoming, learning what I need to learn to become an engineer, and then all of a sudden I'm being told to take diversity courses, that might leave a bit of a bitter pill in my mouth, right? And what we get caught in is something called false consensus bias. Just because it has meaning for me, we sort of assume it's going to have similar meaning for other people. So when I do the D&I training, I found it profound. I thought it was really amazing. It spoke to me, and then, let's bring it into our organization because other people are going to feel the same. And it's just not true. So what we do is, Mike had mentioned civility as being one of the keys in our inclusive learning journey. Civility is really important. Because our brains are constantly trying to map out the ambiguity in the world, if you are my boss, Kathy, and I don't know you overly well, we don't have a lot of emotional capital, and you are snarky with me and you are uncivil towards me, my brain has to map out whether race is a factor in it. It has to. That's just physiologically. That's not even at a cognitive level. And so pulling at that ambiguity is part of that job I have to engage in to ensure I'm psychologically safe. So when we're in trainings, they get split along four different ways. So our e-learning, one would be to look at civility, the generalized, so you understand what civility is and why it matters in organizational life. But another path through would be as an inclusive leader. How do you view civility through the lens of inclusive leadership? Yet another path through would be through the lens of an ally. It doesn't have to be in a formal leadership role, but as somebody who wants to make a difference for the people with whom you work, for your colleagues, how do you understand civility just from the perspective of allied behavior? And then the fourth is from a minoritized lens, as somebody who lives with social oppression, whether it's through gender or sexuality or race, how do I understand civility, what it means for me, and how I can best leverage this new understanding to be my best in the face of these pieces, these challenges. And so what the reason it's designed that way and what we're finding from feedback is that this your own journey thing, there's a what's in it for me, because it's about something that I need. I get to decide, and adult learners need to have that piece where they get to decide. It makes it that much more meaningful. So it's built into the design of everything we do. There's nothing that we do that is medicine. It's what's in it for me from the individual level straight up through the chain to the organizational level.
I can't help be struck with thinking about vulnerability here. And when you're, I think the science of vulnerability is fascinating. And when I think about what you're talking about, I feel vulnerable. I'm like, I don't understand all this stuff. And how am I ever going to understand this stuff? So if I'm a CEO of a company and I'm going, I know I need help, but I'm feeling so vulnerable about how to get started and how to go in the right way. Do you feel that from leaders that you're working with? And how do you help them get over those feelings of vulnerability? because there could be shame in there too of this is my organization. I am not operating in a D&I inclusive place. How do I work my organization through this kind of change? Does that happen?
Absolutely. And it's built into our program. So the first piece of our programs, we think of it as an all staff. It's a 90-minute session to get everybody on the same page. It's designed to move people forward in any change process, 30% of people are going to fight you tooth and nail, no matter what the change process is, right? So the design of our introductory module is really to get people to a place where they're saying, okay, I get it. It makes sense. I don't have to be scared of it. And there's actually something that's going to make our organization better. Okay, we're willing to move forward. And we generally tend to get a very large chunk and kind of eat into that 30%. But the second piece of it is what we call our power dynamics module, and that's for leadership. So that they can get a deeper understanding of what's actually involved outside of the political stuff. Because I don't know, Mike, you know, keep me honest here. I don't think there's a lot of what we do that's political.
It's not, pretty much not.
Yeah, it's based in the science. So we give leaders the ability to understand where they are, where they want to be, and how they move forward. And then I think, and Mike, you can fill in the gaps if I'm missing something. I think more so than anything else, our approach is based in a very, very simple concept. Human beings are generally good. You're going to screw up, but we're generally good. You're going to get your Adolf Hitlers every once in a blue moon, but generally speaking, human beings are good. And so what our overriding message, particularly for leaders who are feeling that, is it's the same thing I say to my kids when they fall, when they play. Pick yourself up, brush yourself off, go do the good work again. Because there will always be people who say you're not doing it fast enough, you're not doing it well enough, but keep to your North Star. We'll help guide you in it. We'll show you the science-based route to where you want to go. And just stay the course. You're going to be good.
And so take us through, Mike, a little bit about how an organization uses the platform. Is this something that every employee gets engaged in? I think of many people listening might think, when I think of an analytics platform, I think how many of this, how many of that, how many of these, right? We're talking about a very different platform here. Let's be clear about behavioral analytics and what that is all about.
For sure. So organizations, as I mentioned, it gives you the ability to put metrics on safety, belonging, inclusion on an ongoing basis. That's number one. Number two, you have the ability to develop your leaders via that inclusive leadership program. And number three, you get to take those metrics and leverage those in your hiring and promotion process. And then number four, we support you with ongoing live training. And again, this is the training that we're talking about here is very much, it's not about making people in your organization experts. It's about leveraging the data. It's about leveraging the behavioral pieces that are tailored and specific to your organization and understanding how to really help your people dive in and become better leaders, it's what I said off the top. Once you see this stuff, you can't unsee it. And once you learn it, you can't unlearn it. So just the avenue to do that. So from an engagement perspective, from an organization perspective, the ability to come in and poll your entire organization, get that baseline metrics around safety, belonging, and inclusion, and understand that, then layer in that inclusive leadership piece and then have access to those ongoing live sessions to support that is kind of that full package. But that's not how all organizations need to start. This is no different than any other large implementation that you're doing or implementation that you're doing in an organization. You have the ability to start with a couple of teams and a set of leaders. You have the ability to start with the executive. Your entry point really is able to, because it scales from small groups to large groups. So your entry point can be where you want it to be. So we have lots of organizations that are like, look, I really need to, I need my executive to get on board, and I want to take our leaders through this inclusive leadership piece. And then they bring in the team metrics after the fact. Some start right out of the gate with. We want that baseline of team metrics because it will help. It will help inform from a leader perspective. So it's, we designed it in a way that's modularized and designed it in a way that you can start where the organization's at. It works alongside of any D&I programs. And lots of our clients have chief diversity officers or heads of D&I. It's a very complementary program to the work that is being done already inside the organization. And it really is designed to be seamless, to allow organizations, you stay in business and focus on what it is that you're in business for, and know that you have a diversity, equity, and inclusion program that is giving your, you're getting constant data, you're building leaders in the way that you want to build them, and you have the ability to support them with live training all the way through it. So it really is designed to be a system that can be embedded quickly and scaled to where you want it to go.
I think that's a great explanation. Clear. I love it. So tell me, what's your goal? What's your hope for the organization? What do you want to accomplish as a company? What's next?
Outside of change the world?
Outside of change the world. Just a little more detail would be better, Lino.
I'll let you go with the detail, Mike.
Yeah, it's if I take it back to the comment on that, that our message hasn't changed, but the way people hear it, you know, they hear it differently. It really is getting this out to as many organizations as possible because this is real. Sexism's real, ableism, heterosexism, homophobia. These are real things, and they happen in the world, and they don't stop at the doors of your organization. They come in every single day, and not in the gross stuff. We're not talking about the gross stuff. You know, most HR practices have a you know, they can handle the gross stuff.
Yeah.
What lives in the ambiguity? So being able to provide an organization something that allows their people to say, hey, listen, that stuff happens to me out there, but I know when I come to work, that's not what it is here, because that's not the way that we operate here. Can you imagine when people are allowed to think with their big brain, as Lino talked about before, not being hijacked, mm-hmm. and how much innovation and productivity they're going to bring to the workplace, how much they're going to want to stay where you are. It's like, yeah, I'm not leaving. This is amazing here. That's what we can do with organizations. And we want to do that with as many organizations as possible. And that's really the mission that we're on. This is something that everyone should have access to. Every organization should be able to embed this. Because the end goal, yes, it will change the world.
Yeah, well, Lino, I've heard you speak a number of times, and you talk about complex stuff. Today, we talked about some complex stuff. Every time I've heard you speak, you are always very hopeful. So building on what Mike said, yes, you're trying to change the world. Tell me what the next 4 or 5 years look like for you and the organization in doing exactly that. What's your perspective on it?
I think in the next 4 or 5 years, what I see happening, because I truly believe the world has changed in spite of a lot of the ugliness that we are seeing out there. I think when you have organizations that start to recognize what healthy looks like, you don't want to give that up. Like, at a very baseline level, you know, let's go back to that Mercer study that I was talking about. If you've only got 14 or 15% of your executives female, either you believe that women just don't work, you know, belong in leadership, or you got to recognize that there's a systemic problem. Because if it's not one of those two, it's that you're doing something intentionally to keep women out. So it's got to be either systemic or that they don't belong. So let's go with that they don't belong. Mm-hmm. It's not an option for you, right? Let's go with, you recognize there's a systemic issue. at that point, can you, you know, almost to the exact opposite of what Mike had said, think of the amount of innovation you lose. Think of how many Einsteins just never get a shot out there, right? That's what I see happening over the next 4 or 5 years. For organizations, when they start to develop healthy cultures, where they start to be able to really plumb their minoritized folks, actually have the potential start to get reached, where people can come into work and put that self-defense mechanism down.
Away.
And really be their true selves when they come in. The loyalty, the passion, all of that stuff that we're going to start accessing, that's what I'm seeing in the next few years. And again, there's going to be a strategic advantage to that for organizations that are engaging it, right? So I don't see this ending. That's the hopeful thing. I think if you had told me, 20 years ago, if you told me 10 years ago that we would be working with large financial institutions and using words like racism openly with executive leadership, I would have had the biggest belly laugh you'd ever heard. But now it's not just that we're having these real conversations. They're conversations that people want to hear and want to do something about. And that's incredibly hopeful. That's an amazing change in the world.
Well, it's interesting. The hopefulness always comes through. It came through here this morning. I appreciate that. And I am so excited about what the future holds for Mesh Diversity. If organizations want to learn more about your organization, Mike, how do they find you? How do they get a demo? How do they see content that's going to be helpful for them to make a decision to continue a conversation, particularly with you?
Yeah, for sure. So meshdiversity.com, our website, you can hop in there, book demos. Of course, anyone that wants to reach out directly to myself or Lino, it's as simple as mike@meshdiversity.com or lino@meshdiversity.com. We're just really, really excited about where organizations see this. And I just want to add one piece, because you touched on it before, Kathy, too, about the vulnerability maybe of some senior executive that oh, I'm not doing this right, or how do I do this? And I think what Lino just said is a really important point. This is a systems problem. Like, we know it's not the people at the top saying, oh, I'm trying to keep people down. That's not it. So, you know, as a leader of a large organization, you get to look and say, this is a systems problem. I know that there's a solution out there. So let's go tackle that. It's not about me, right?
Yeah,
it's not. So you have the ability to kind of embrace this and approach it in a way that doesn't have yourself saying, geez, I'm doing a bad job here. Because this is a system, and it's the reason that it's you know, stayed in for hundreds of years. We now have a root.
Well, I'm excited that you have your roots in New Brunswick. You have employment in New Brunswick. It's coming out of Canada. That you are a leader, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you both as guests today on the Tech Talks show. And I look forward to our continued conversations.
Thanks so much, Kathy.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thanks. Cheers. Weren't they great guests today? Thank you, Mike and Lino. You know, after our conversation, I found myself doing a lot of reflection on some of the messages that you shared with all of us. I mentioned during the podcast that these conversations can make you feel vulnerable. That's healthy, by the way. But while that can happen, and you do feel that vulnerability, they are also empowering as you gain knowledge and you learn from those who are teaching and leading others. I have so much to learn, and I hope with this D&I series, you're learning along with me. It's extraordinary how much Lino has brought to this work at Mesh from 20 plus years of study and practice. You never know when someone in your circle of friends or in a network is going to have the skills that you need at that moment, which was the case with these two gentlemen. They both had talents to offer, a passion to drive change, and now they are truly trying to change the world, as they both mentioned. When Lino talked about the systems problem that is diversity, inclusion, and belonging, it triggered in me some thoughts around how challenging change can be. And then events happen, like the Me Too movement, the murder of George Floyd, and others. And the world took real notice. I loved how Mike said that their messaging at Mesh didn't change after these events, but it was how the world was hearing and reacting to these messages that changed. They went from being asked about ROI as it related to D&I to that no longer being at the forefront of every conversation. With their platform and learning approach and this base of safety, belonging, and inclusion that they believe to be foundational for healthy companies, I found it got me seeing our D&I challenges from new perspectives. When I often think of D&I, I first go to having a broad representation of diverse people at the table. What really hit home for me today was how the work that they are doing is working so that everyone can bring their true selves to the table. That belonging means I'm in the conversation. All of me is in the conversation. The atmosphere is safe for me to bring my true self to it. I absolutely loved that and thought it was brilliant. Think of the innovation that can happen with team members bringing their true selves to work, and also the innovation that's lost in an unsafe place where you don't feel included and that you belong. At Mesh, they are building stronger and healthier people and companies. When an organization is healthy, there's no going back. It's true. We all can relate to it. With their platform and company leadership, it's that combination of science and data science, valuable and reliable metrics, training and facilitation approaches, and the focus on learning journeys, not only for leaders within an organization, but for all employees. Thank you, Mesh. This is important work right now, and we're glad you're leading the way. To check out more about Mesh Diversity, their diversity intelligence platform, and how they are combining science and data science, visit meshdiversity.com. And you can reach Mike at mike@meshdiversity.com and Lino at llk@meshdiversity.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you soon for episode 28.